everyone. Welcome to the 417th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have an amazing show for you this week. We're going to be talking about 6G, all the Gs, so many Gs. And then also in cellular news, we're going to give an update on who's selling IoT modules. Woo! Unibiz, in a completely different form of connectivity, has open source Sigfox. We're going to talk about what that means. And going over to the smart home, personal experience and just general curiosity, we're going to talk about what is elder care? What should it look like in the smart home? We also have a whole section on security breaches and flaws. You're going to love it. And we'll be talking about a company that's approaching security in kind of a unique way that I thought was worth mentioning. And we have a market update from Bluetooth. I know. We talked actually with the Bluetooth SIG last week, but we didn't hear all the market update news. So that's what we're going to talk about. And we have a follow-up on Kevin's kind of meh HomeKit experience from last week. We're also going to hear from our sponsor. We've got a new one this week. It is On Logic. So yay. And you're going to hear from our guest. This week's guest is Tarun Gupta. And we're going to be talking about the magic combination of cellular and satellite that is coming this year. So all of this and more await you. But first, a message from one of our sponsors. This week's sponsor is Silicon Labs, which is a leader in secure, intelligent wireless technology. They've launched this year's Tech Talks schedule. This year's Tech Talks include a dedicated technology series for Matter, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and LPWANs in order to help you build the development skills needed to deliver cutting-edge IoT products. You can join Silicon Labs experts and industry leaders for these one-hour virtual trainings created for developers by developers. Tune in, ask questions, and accelerate your device development today. Register now at scilabs.com. Okay, Kevin, let's talk about 6G. Not Wi-Fi 6, which you guys might be thinking, because we do talk a lot about Wi-Fi 6. This is 6G. This is the G stands for, well, it doesn't stand for anything. It stands for the 3GPP standards, which is the GSM. That is, okay, yeah.
More Gs are better. More Gs are better.
Yeah, you want all the Gs. So in this case, we saw an article by EE Times talking about 6G. And right now we're in 5G. And we feel like we've been in 5G for a really long time. And it's because 5G was really promulgated very early on. Like 8 or 9 years ago, we were talking about 5G like it was real. And Qualcomm and other companies were really pitching this hard at trade shows. And the reason for this is because 5G was the beginning of moving cellular connectivity away from computing devices. It was kind of for the IoT. Because you think about computers and cell phones were primarily what were on these networks. Yes, there were always things like cars, alarm, well, not always. In 4G, there were cars, and in 3G, but in alarm systems and that sort of thing. But for the most part, it was designed to give maximum capacity for mobile broadband service. With 5G, what happened is people were like, we could connect lots of things. So we could connect tiny little tracking devices. We could connect cars. We could connect, I don't know, medical devices. We could connect anything. And so the spec started to focus less on just capacity and more on other attributes. So things like latency became more important, things like time-sensitive networking, basically prioritizing certain packets over other packets. And there were also things around like different types of spectrum uses, network slicing, so ensuring quality of service over spectrum for things that really had to get to where they were going without your Netflix stream interrupting it, right? And that happened in 5G. And a lot of people, when thinking about mobile standards, they say you think of the odd standards like 1, 3, and 5 as like the intro case study. Like, oh, I think we're going to do this. And they start throwing a bunch of features in there. And then the evens are when it really gets good. So when we talked about 3G, that was broadband for phones. That was like for the iPhone. Remember when that came out?
Oh, yeah.
It sucked. Like, your connectivity was terrible. That's because they were just kind of trying out these features. And then in 4G, it got really good. So 5G, I don't really know if it's quote-unquote sucked, but you're going to see a lot more efficiency, a lot more streamlining of features in 6G. And so, and the features they're focusing on are things like latency, time-sensitive network or network slicing. So basically ensuring QoS and managing the services on that spectrum. And then things like precise positioning and satellite convergence. I don't know. What else is in there, Kevin? Anything?
In the article, they say network as a sensor, which is kind of interesting to me. And, you know, this isn't to say that like the use cases for 5G aren't necessarily going away. I mean, I think 5G enabled things that we don't talk about on the show because they're not relevant, such as the low latency for mobile cloud gaming and video conferencing and things like that. But now it's like, what other use cases do we need to, we being like the GSMA? No.
GSMA.
It is the GSMA. There's too many standards and groups here, but yes. What else can we optimize to bring out new applications and use cases for? So that's really what this article, I think, is about.
Yeah. And the sensing technologies, I'm going to have to call Nokia up and Ericsson up and be like, hey, what the heck are you talking about? Because we're seeing things around RF sensing in non-cellular standards. So things like Wi-Fi, millimeter wave sensing, all of that is basically using the disruption in the wireless signals from those things wandering through to kind of say, oh, there's motion here or a person or even fall detection. I don't know if that's the case, if that's what they're looking for here.
You know, I could see that more in the automotive space. I mean, yes, you have location with GPS, but going up to a GPS satellite and getting information and acting upon it when you could do it on a faster local network. By local, I mean that the 6G network closer to yourself, you know, there could be values there.
Yeah. And they also, I mean, precise positioning is part of the current, it's the LTE Advanced. So it's part of the 5G. It's release 17. It came out last summer. You're going to hear release 17 later on in this show, by the way. This was a big deal last summer's release. It had precise positioning, which is, it's not centimeter level accuracy, but it's a couple feet, which is better than GPS. So we'll have some of that. It's already coming out and it's just going to get better and more power efficient. And that's a really,
well, that's always that's good.
A really important factor here because a lot of these sensors and the things in industrial, yes, there are power cords, but the industrial world is trying to move to more flexible manufacturing systems, which means you don't want to have to draw power cords whenever you want to move something around. So you want to have these sensors that you can just like attach to things. And their battery, or ideally, powered by energy harvesting, or maybe it's over-the-air power transfer. Who knows? So, 6G is not here today. It is not going to be here for another couple years, but it is something we're going to start seeing more of. We saw demos at Mobile World Congress. We're going to start seeing more marketing and hype around this. I wrote something probably, I want to say 2 or 3 years ago because I was overwhelmed by 6G pitches all of a sudden, but it's coming and it should be out in just a couple of years. So that's what y'all should know.
Before that, I think we've got the 5G advanced bits coming.
That's what's coming this year. So we're seeing a lot of new silicon come out this year in products that we saw the silicon come out late last year and last year. And are now being standardized. You know how they put out chips ahead of time, mm-hmm. saying it will become, they'll do it backwards. They'll do a firmware update to update it to the current standard when it gets released. So we're seeing that happen and that's happening now. And we're going to see new devices come out that are 5G or LTE advanced, which is like that release 17 that I talked about.
Yeah. So. It's interesting. Like I don't normally go here, but because of this story, I went to the 3GPP.org. site where they have all like some nice high level charts and graphs and documentation on what's in each release. And like, if you look forward, I'm like looking at the 5G advanced right now. And they're even talking about, you know, the next release and they're like ambient power enable internet of things, satellite access, a couple of other things, uncrewed aerial vehicles. I mean, they're trying to come up with all these different use cases to strive towards to provide the technology that will allow that. So it's kind of neat to see where they're going, actually.
Yeah. And you know what? Probably in another couple of weeks, I'll write something up about this because I love the G's.
I would like to see something that's in release 18, if you talk to these folks about personal IoT networks, they mention.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what that is.
I'm like, Nokia, Ericsson, call me.
Yeah.
That might actually work. We'll see. Okay. Or Qualcomm, call me. All right. Let's talk about IoT chipsets shipments from 2022. This is research out from Counterpoint Research. And basically, they noted that cellular IoT module shipments rose 14% in 2022. And the huge winner here was Quectel, which is a module maker. They had like 39% market share. So yay. And Qualcomm led the way for chipsets. So also yay. Chipsets go into modules, just so y'all know. So the chipset is the bare bones. It's the first layer. And then the modules have chipsets plus peripherals and anything else that you might need. Maybe multiple chipsets so you can support multiple standards. Anyway, oh, it was 38.5% was Quectel, not 39%. I won't round up there just yet.
Either way, second place was 7.5% there.
Yeah.
That's a massive lead.
Yeah. And at the chipset side, Qualcomm has a 40% market share of the cellular IoT chipset market. This does not surprise me. Followed by, again, some more Chinese vendors, Unisoc and ASR. I was actually surprised we didn't see MediaTek.
Oh, no. Well, MediaTek is on there. 5.4%.
Yeah, but MediaTek really, I guess they're just in the Wi-Fi side, not in the cellular side.
Yeah, they focus on Wi-Fi traditionally, or have so far. I was actually surprised to see Sony on there.
Oh, yeah, they have Sony Altair.
Oh, yeah.
That's my guess. But yeah.
It's only 2%. Qualcomm has nothing to worry about there.
Yeah. So basically, there are scores of unlicensed technologies available in the IoT market. So think Wi-Fi, LPWANs like LoRaWAN, et cetera. But cellular is still doing well. And one of the big reasons is because people are finally adopting NB-IoT, apparently, which for a while had really struggled. And NB-IoT is the low data rate version of cellular IoT. So it was the most popular cellular-based low-power wide area network. And then that was followed by 4G Cat 1 and 4G Cat 4. And those are like Cat 1 and Cat 4 are like a few megabits, maybe 1 megabit per second kind of data rates. So higher than NB-IoT, which is very small, but not as much as like a true LTE modem that can do, I don't even know how many gigabytes per second now, 1.2.
It's ridiculous now, which is a good thing. I mean, from a consumer standpoint. And then all these bandwidth levels that you just mentioned kind of equate to costs if you're a device maker too. So if you've got, what do you pay for your cell phone 5G? You're paying probably $40, $50 a month plus whatever per line. I haven't checked the prices lately on LTE or NB-IoT, but it just seems to decrease each time as a result.
Yeah, the modules are much less expensive and the connectivity costs are as well.
Right. So a module or plan for every device. You just have to choose the right one, obviously, if you're a device maker.
Yeah. But cellular is not the only interesting technology. And we've been talking about LPWANs, gosh, it feels like every week since the middle of February. And the reason we've been talking about it is because Unibiz has been doing a lot of work with their acquisition of Sigfox. They acquired Sigfox out of bankruptcy, I think it was last year. And as part of that, they announced this idea of creating a unified LPWAN. LPWAN is just low power wide area network. Think things that are transferring a few kilobits per second of data every now and then. This is not camera data, this is sensor data. And it's really cheap. The idea here is to make it really easy for customers to move things around as needed on different low-power wide area networks. So Unibiz has a LoRaWAN option. They have Sigfox. They also have Meoti, which is a proprietary technology that's actually made by a company up in Canada that we've written about. And so what Unibiz is trying to do is to let a customer come to them and say, hey, I just want low-power connectivity that is easy and works for this number of devices. And then Unibiz is like, all right, here I've got this type of coverage, here I've got that type of coverage, let me create this for you and just give it to you as you manage it as one thing, and I'll manage all the complexity underneath, which is great. So Unibiz also includes cellular. So they do have LTE Cat-M and NB-IoT as part of it. So what they're doing is they're opening up the Sigfox code. It used to be proprietary, and now they're going to make it publicly available. Anybody can build Sigfox-based devices, which is great because a lot of people loved Sigfox, especially compared to LoRaWAN, which was much harder to implement and build like back-end support for. Sigfox was easy, so that's why people were like, yay! So now that that's available, we actually might, I mean, I don't know if the LoRa Alliance should worry, but they might want to keep an eye on this.
Yeah, because it's open source out on the Sigfox GitHub repo. I'm looking at it now.
Yeah, and you can build your own Sigfox solution. And I think this will be really, really important. Well, we're going to have to get the Unibiz guys on the show. I know that I've asked, and hopefully that'll happen soon. Because this could be really compelling, especially when you think about Amazon just last week said they had opened up their Sidewalk network, which is a proprietary LoRa network, but it is also an LPWAN. And we're seeing a lot more development of LoRaWAN networks everywhere. And the other thing worth noting about this is Unibiz says they are going to expedite LPWAN crossover with LoRaWAN, Meoti, Wi-Sun, NB-IoT and LTE-M with Sigfox. So again, super exciting news in the LPWAN space. All right, let's switch from the enterprise and infrastructure news to actual end users. And I saw basically another home care smart hub. So another gateway designed for sitting in somebody's house and monitoring their health or for falls or that sort of thing. And I started thinking about what do we want from elder care systems or at home, what is it called when you want your
like monitoring
aging in place?
Oh, aging in place. Yes. Yes. That's what I do every day.
Yes. We're all aging in place. So I started thinking about what I want one of these systems to look like and what's overkill and how they should be developed. So the first thing I came up with is, my God, we need a standard. And I say this because we need it to evolve over time. Because at first you might start with something very simple, like fall detection, or maybe you just want a couple sensors that you can place somewhere so you know that someone got out of bed in the morning and made their coffee. But maybe as things get worse, and you know, maybe they have a fall or you're starting to worry, you add fall detection, or you add a little button system that calls, you know, for help. So I feel, first of all, you need to have interoperability among different devices, because you don't want to have to be buying one system for one reason and then another. So that's one. Two, you need security. You know, I don't know if the Matter folks are thinking about this, but what Matter did with enabling trusted devices within a system to talk to each other and to share their data between each other locally on that system, I think any sort of elder care system needs to have that as well. You also need reliability. So you need to know that if something didn't get sent, like a packet, like the fall detection alert didn't get sent, you need to know. So I think there needs to be some real like cellular level reliability built into these things, not best effort. So that's kind of on the tech side.
Yeah. I'll kind of add a little bit, or maybe even expand on what you're saying a little bit, because when I look at what's available today, most people are aware of solutions that generally integrate with existing devices, such as your Echoes or Nests or whatever it may be. I don't think that's a good way to go. And maybe that's what you were getting at with, you know, it needs to be a standalone system that can talk to others. But the reason I say that is because you're adding features and complexity, even if it's just perceived complexity, that I don't think helps sell the aging in place concept. I kind of like a use case specific product. And the one we noticed that was just announced actually is that. And I like it because it is that, in a sense, because it's got a camera. It's got a speaker for voice calls or video calls. The camera can move a little bit. I mean, it can pan, I'll say, but it also has hooks into other devices for monitoring. And I think this is a key one, health wearables. Because why not have that as part of the system to just keep track of vitals of these folks And the system can then, you know, route any information that's like, hey, this person is an AFib or whatever to a provider or to somebody else who's in the family and so on. So I like that. You could do fall detection as well. I totally agree with that. But the key thing to me, and maybe you seem surprised that I said this, is to have a really specific type of device that doesn't do anything and everything. Because when you do that, then you, I think, open it up to more of the security challenges that people are afraid of.
I think we think very differently about this.
Ooh.
I want to be able to add things as needed. Like, I don't mind having a dedicated device, but I think it should be a dedicated sensor or detection that works with an exit like a Madam A or a HomeKit or this particular hub. Like, basically everything should have like elder care approved standard.
Mm-hmm.
And if you buy anything within that, it's all going to interoperate. So I could buy this particular hub that has the pan cam, you know, maybe it's a RF sensing component, video call or a voice activation, whatever. But that will also work from an elder care approved thing with any elder care approved alternative motion sensor that I want to stick. Like, I just don't want it to be all one system.
But that's okay. But let me ask you a question. What is the addition or the working with the, say, a Madam A? What is the compelling reason for that? I'm not saying there isn't one. I'm just curious.
People have Madam A in their homes already. So if I have Madam A in my home, and Madam A is an elder care certified device, then I could go buy any fall detection thing and it would work with Madam A,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think people want, because I think it'd be easier just to add to that system than go buy a data. So if I have a Nest Cam that's elder care approved, maybe that also, the elder care approved thing means that you have a set of machine learning things that identify falls or something concerning that then sends an alert. And that's part of the standard that could be really interesting and scary to develop. So from a sensor perspective, I don't want a camera. I don't think a lot of older people want a camera.
Right, right.
So I think a set of millimeter wave sensors designed for fall detection that you could put in different rooms, like in the bathroom. I think that's a little bit more privacy friendly.
Yeah.
And then I also think you want voice control to be able to shout things out. I think you want sensors to understand, did this person get up in the morning? Did they open the fridge, for example, would be
sure,
good.
Sure.
And I would love some sort of robust presence detection, which you could have with the millimeter wave, like it do fall detection and say the person is in this room, right?
Right. I don't disagree with anything you've said. I guess my stance is because I don't know that I want any of that health data going to the big tech companies of today.
Well, you don't have to. You could have someone build a local hub for it easily. But I don't know. Like, if someone already has a Madam A, I think that's a really good entry point for them.
Yeah, yeah.
And they may not care. And this gets to the second element. The second element is I think this is a subscription service. Because I think at a certain point in time, you're going to need to have always-on monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
So I know people hate subscriptions, and maybe you can start out with like a, when someone falls, call my cell phone, right? Call a bunch of caregiver cell phones. But I ultimately think that this is going to be something you pay for. And I think when you consider the value, paying something like 20 or 30 bucks a month, it's a lot, but I think it's worth it.
I agree completely. There has to be a subscription component. There could be a low cost or no cost, you know, I'll call it self-monitoring through your family members that are attached to the system. But yeah, and see, that might sound strange to me because like I will not pay currently for security monitoring for my home, but that's because it's relatively easy for me. And honestly, everything of value could always be replaced. But people and their health cannot be replaced. So I place more of a value. Therefore, I'm more willing to pay for a monitoring sensor or service rather for, say, my elderly parents and so on. That's where my mindset is and where I changed over to, yeah, I'll pay.
Yeah. And like, for example, one of my in-laws has a Lively device, and this is a push button device. It's kind of like the I've fallen and I can't get up. And so we pay $50 for the device, and then we pay, I don't know if it's 25 or 35 bucks a month for urgent response service and a link out. And they actually have fall detection, but you have to be wearing the device. It's something that you either hold in your hand or in your pocket, or you wear it on a lanyard. The downside is people don't wear these. So I found that thing. I was hanging out with my in-laws. I found that thing hanging from like the doorknob or by the bedside table. So that's where I do think like things like millimeter wave detection becomes really important, because you don't have to worry about that. And maybe you have a button to confirm or a wearable device. So that's our thinking there. I'd love to hear from y'all about this, just because I think it's, everybody wants to build this, but I feel like they want to build this and offer this in a way that is very closed, that's going to make it much harder to get people used to it. It's basically the same mistake we made with the smart home before we decided to introduce Matter, and that held it back by like 10 years. And I have parents who are aging now, so I need this to be like awesome today.
Yeah, get on it.
Get on it. Okay, let's talk about security again. First up, I'm going to tell you about a device. So Doorbird, they make a, it's mostly for apartment complexes, MDUs, and that sort of setting. It's a fancy intercom system and door opening system, door lock, whatever system. They actually added something they're calling the Internet Firewall to their devices. And what this is it's any device, any Doorbird device that you have gets a internal Internet Firewall product that basically stops any unauthorized network traffic from talking to DoorBot devices. And this is really interesting because we've seen a couple hacks around these intercom systems that let people get into buildings or see in, these are video IP things, so they actually can see into the systems. And I like that Doorbird is like, you know what? We're just going to build only the DoorBot stuff can, unless you're fancy and you want to do it by hand, only the DoorBot stuff can talk to the DoorBot stuff, which is probably the right way to do that for everybody who's not a tech expert.
Well, and it makes sense for their market segment if they're mostly into like multi-user dwellings and so on, because one firewall can, you know, manage hundreds of devices, for example. Is it something I would buy for my home? No. But I mean, it's nice to see that this is an option.
Other security issues. There's another ultrasound attack to disarm a smart home system. Okay, I love these because it's using physics, basically, to mess with the IoT world. And researchers basically said that Siri, Google's assistant, Amazon's Madam A, all can be remotely hijacked using ultrasonic sounds, which you really can't hear, and it'll let you make phone calls, you could use it to transfer money, disable alarm systems, unlock doors.
You won't know it's happening either, because the first command drops the speaker volume to 6%.
Yeah, so basically, it goes after these speakers with this ultrasonic thing, the speaker hears it and starts obeying. So, and you can do this from, I mean, it's not like over the internet you could do it, but you could do it from farther away than you think. So, that's worth noting that that's still there.
How about garage doors?
Yeah. Why don't you tell us about garage doors?
I've never heard of this brand, but it's out there, obviously. It's called Nex, N-E-X-X. It's a Wi-Fi garage door opener. And apparently, a researcher has found that, basically found a hack that you could access your own Nex garage door or anybody else's with this hack. And he has given the information to the company, and they're just not responding. And I believe Vice has reported on this, actually Motherboard, which is Tech by Vice, and they're reaching out to the company too and not really getting much information here. So,
yeah, and this is a remote hack, so that's important to know. So basically, someone can remotely open and shut your garage door. So if you have the Nex devices, I would not use them. I would take them off your network. And if you really still like the convenience, then lock the door from your house to your garage.
Which I don't do, but I will.
Yeah, a lot of people don't. So. And there is also a Wi-Fi protocol flaw that allows hackers to hijack network traffic, according to Bleeping Computer. This is a flaw in the Wi-Fi standard. And basically, it's designed to save power. So what happens is you send all of this device traffic. It can be queued up. And when it's in the queued state and getting buffered, basically, it's not encrypted. It's staying out there. And then it's waiting for the client to wake up. And then when the client wakes up, that's when the traffic goes through and gets encrypted. So an attacker can spoof a device on the network and be like, oh, I'm asleep and now I'm waking up, and then get all that secured traffic. Mm-hmm. Now, what's in that traffic? No idea. It could be great. It could be nothing. But it's worth noting Cisco has acknowledged the flaw, and they are...
They don't really think it's a big deal, but then again, I wouldn't expect them to say otherwise. So they say the information gained by the attacker would be of minimal value in a securely configured network, the key being securely configured network.
Yeah. So the device they have about like what device is calling in, what device is trying to transmit traffic could be valuable. You can detect things like, is it a security sensor? Is it, I mean, you're not going to get your banking routing information, but I think you could get decent information about broad sense of what's happening in the physical world of the home or office that has Wi-Fi-based sensors reporting in. So,
well, I think the other issue, too, is that according to the report, that you could use your own IP server to inject data into the connection, and therefore maybe you could inject malware or something else that could later then send back more data than just what was, you know, going through the router at the time.
Boo.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Last week, we had the Bluetooth SIG on the show talking about electronic shelf labels and ambient IoT. So new standards coming for that. The same day that ran, we also released or we also received just the annual update on Bluetooth. So I'm not sure why we didn't talk about that, but we didn't. And that's okay. We talked about all the important cool stuff, which is like what's coming and how ESL electronic shelf labels for Bluetooth will work and the idea of them creating standards around ambient IoT. But, you know, Bluetooth is still a big business. They shipped 4.9 billion Bluetooth devices in 2022. They expect to ship 5.4 billion this year.
Man, that's a lot.
That is a lot. I know.
Yeah.
Billion with a B.
But like everything I buy these days has Bluetooth in it.
Oh, yeah.
And for good reason. I mean,
I just saw like a little scrolling ring. That is a Bluetooth-powered scrolling ring, so you could scroll your TikTok videos while like not touching your phone.
Okay, well, I wouldn't buy that, but yes, I get it.
But I mean, the point is, there's like all these crazy things. And like I mentioned with this scrolling device, peripherals are going to continue to drive the growth of Bluetooth device shipments. They say 3.5 billion of this year's Bluetooth shipments will be peripheral devices. Yikes.
Mm. I'm impressed by the number that they're projecting with Bluetooth LE audio, not because of the audio itself, but because of using it in hearing aids, over-the-counter hearing aids.
Oh, what's that?
5.7-time increase in annual shipments over the next 5 years.
Well, LE audio has only been around for like a few years.
True. It hasn't really taken off yet. Yes.
Yeah. So that makes sense. And we're also with AuraCast, which is where you can actually basically get from a stream from a device to multiple Bluetooth devices. So that means like I could now have my Bluetooth headset in and my husband could have his Bluetooth headset in.
And you could both listen to the podcast.
Exactly.
I know.
On one device.
I know. We do it one at a time in my house, so because I only download it once.
There you go. No, you're supposed to download it a bunch of times. Everybody download it a bunch of times and listen to it on your own Bluetooth headset. Okay. There's really a lot in here. I'll link to this. I'm not going to talk about it too much more because there's been enough Bluetooth on the show.
There's a lot of charts. It's very visual and a lot of good information provided concisely.
Yeah. On the IoT side, they're saying 112 million Bluetooth asset tracking devices will ship in 2023. That's not a lot. I think LPWAN is probably a better option for asset tracking, but we'll still see some within like campuses. So, you know, that's probably where you're going to see that.
Wearables will be big.
Yeah, bigger.
Bigger.
In the smart home, they're saying Bluetooth, there's going to be 45% of the smart home shipments will come from smart appliances, and that's going to just be them connecting. They'll have a Bluetooth radio so they can connect. Smart lighting might actually be connecting to the lighting. And then the rest is real tiny.
Oh, no, no. The biggest number of all is at the bottom. And it's relevant.
Oh, say more.
The total addressable market. It's not sales, but the total addressable market for ambient IoT devices. 10 trillion.
Yeah. So ambient IoT is not smart home. Ambient IoT is basically like low powered sensors that are battery or energy harvested powered using over-the-air power or harvested energy, there are going to be stickers that say things like temperature of a thing and its location. But yes, we talked about that.
I got you.
But there's Bluetooth is not the only horse in that race, not the only connectivity horse in the ambient IoT race. That's actually like when we talked about in our DECT NR, that's one of the other standards that could be there. MBIoT might be, although I don't know how it really scales. MIOTI is actually an option there. So there's a lot of options in the ambient IoT race, but go for Bluetooth. It is going to be a big market and they should try for it. Okay, that concludes this segment of the show. And now it is time for the Internet of Things podcast hotline, the segment of the show where we talk to you. So if you would like to give us a call at 512-623-7424 and ask us your question about the smart home, we'd love to hear it. And it is the end of the month.
The beginning of the new month.
It's the beginning of the month. My glass is half empty. What about you, Kevin?
Always half full.
All right. Well, our winner of the Hubitat for March was Kevin Daly. So Kevin, yay! Congratulations to you. We'll be sending you out that Hubitat device. And that means April is a new month and we have a new contest. I was hoping we'd try it before, but I kind of want to send you a Nanoleaf Essentials kit.
Which I just got in the middle of the show.
Oh, tell me a little bit.
I have a box that's got Nanoleaf Essentials in it with matter. That's all I can tell you because I didn't even open the box yet. But I will be doing that and probably talking about it next week.
So I'm thinking about sending y'all a Nanoleaf Essentials just basic light bulb kit. It'll be a 3-pack. It's many colors, and I think it'll be fun. So that's my new plan for April winners, if you're into that. And you can give us a call at 512-623-7424. And now let's hear this week's voicemail.
Hi, I'm Michael from Cleveland, Tennessee. I've been a longtime fan of Stacey and Waffles, thanks to This Week in Google, and recently started listening to your podcast. I've had another raft of Zigbee bulbs die on me, catastrophically, as in didn't just go flickery, turned into outright paperweights, dropped off the network. And now I need to buy some new ones. Or do I need to wait for matter bulbs? Either way, my home assistant setup can support either, but shopping for them has been a nightmare because I want reliable RGBW Zigbee or matter bulbs, hopefully ones that act as repeaters, although I know that that's achingly rare, and the ones that I had that did act reliably as repeaters were not reliable as light bulbs. It's been a special headache, and I've been doing IoT since X10 devices back in the day. Drove my roommates nuts. Thanks for any help you can provide, and thanks for all the wonderful content on your podcast.
When we were talking about this voicemail, you and I were looking at all kinds of different Zigbee bulbs and so on, and I started to think, why are we making this so hard on ourselves? Now, we don't know Michael's budget, but because he's going to, sounds like he's got a lot of lights to replace, but I would just go with Philips Hue for this, even though the matter update to the bridge was just pushed back.
Well, and it's just going to, the Philips Hue is just going to bridge it over to matter. It's not going to let you directly address the light bulbs. You will only be able to use matter to address the bridge, and then the bridge will give the commands to the
right.
light bulbs.
In the meantime, the hub or bridge is using Zigbee, and you're good to go. I mean, to me, that seems like an optimal solution, but there's cost involved.
So, Michael, you've called us in. Did you call us this month? Is Michael this month? I can't remember.
Yes.
If not, call us again and ask us a new question, and you'll be entered to win the Nanoleaf Essentials bulbs, which would get you started as well.
True.
So here's the deal. If you go with a matter-enabled light bulb today, like the Nanoleaf Essentials are thread-based, not every system yet supports thread. So you're going to be kind of straddling the ecosystem for a couple months before like Amazon supports it. The HomeKit support is there.
Finally.
So Google supports Thread, but.
Well, he is Home Assistant. He said.
Okay. So then he's fine. The other option is, you know, GE Sync has direct Wi-Fi bulbs that are pretty good. Those aren't matter supported yet. I don't know if GE is going to reverse to support like backwards compatibility on these or if you should wait. They do plan to support matter, or they said so at CES, but they haven't launched those bulbs.
It would be matter over Wi-Fi too, I would presume.
They have a Wi-Fi bulb and they have a Bluetooth bulb. Now, you said nothing about Bluetooth, and I hate Bluetooth light bulbs, so I'm like, don't do that. I know, Kevin, you didn't mind, but I didn't like it. So you're kind of in a, it's an awkward time to do this. If I were in your shoes, because I have so much crazy faith in matter, also because I have a NanoLeaf device that will act as a thread border router, I feel pretty good getting the matter light bulbs from NanoLeaf. But you may not. And if you want Zigbee, I would say Philips Hue is still old reliable, followed by the GE Sync light bulbs, because those are actually quite nice. And you've got the software that used to be from Savant. So those are my options.
And I've used the GE Sync ones in the past. They are actually quite good.
Now, you mentioned having them as a repeater. The Wi-Fi bulbs are not going to be like repeaters. So you are going to have good network coverage for all places for those. The thread devices, if you have, and these are light bulbs, so they'll be a powered node. So they will also act as like a forwarder as part of a thread network because they're powered. And which is what I think you mean by repeater, because these are mesh network and they will forward other thread messages from like sensors that are not powered. So hopefully that helps you. And, you know, fingers crossed for you to be the April winner there. Okay. That concludes the Internet of Things podcast hotline. Remember, if you'd like to ask us a question, you can call us at 512-623-7424. And that concludes this segment of the show, but please stay tuned for our guest, Tarun Gupta, talking about actually Release 17 and bringing satellite and cellular technologies together. But first, a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is OnLogic. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is OnLogic, and I have Derek Fanton from OnLogic here to talk to us about how their customers use their systems. Hey Derek, can you just tell us a little bit more about OnLogic?
Hi Stacy, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. OnLogic creates small form factor industrial computers that are designed to last, built to order, and delivered quickly to our customers all over the world. Customers turn to us for systems that thrive where your average consumer PC or even other industrial computers might fail. By asking the right questions and working hard to understand what they need, our team has the pleasure of helping some of the most innovative companies in the world overcome their technology challenges, whether they're using our computers for manufacturing, automation, medical solutions, smart city projects, or really anything else that requires reliable computing power. We have teams in North America and Europe who directly support customer orders, and locations in Taiwan and Malaysia that support our U.S. engineering team, as well as help manage our supply chain to ensure the best possible lead times.
What is one of the coolest things that you've heard a customer use your computers for?
I love that question. That one's always such a fun one. Our computers power everything from underwater remote operated vehicles to power systems at solar and wind farms. But if I had to name one thing that's caught my attention recently, I'd probably point to this company that uses our computers under every seat of a virtual roller coaster experience. It's like a motion ride where you sit down and are transported to a full-blown amusement park and whip around the track. And it's all choreographed and actuated by OnLogic computers.
Why do your customers love working with OnLogic?
You know, the feedback that we usually get is about having a combination of the right technology for the customer's project and our proactive approach to understanding what they're trying to do in order to help match them with the right computer for the job. Every connected sensor, video frame, data point at a business holds valuable insights, and we create solutions to help users access that information. For example, many of our systems use Intel's purpose-built embedded processors. Intel's hardware makes it easier to gather useful, accurate data and transform it into awareness for autonomous systems that can be used to boost efficiency, increase productivity, and improve safety. We recently heard from a customer that said, quote, "I came for the hardware, but I stayed for the team." And honestly, that's exactly what we want to hear. We really pride ourselves on working directly with customers to get them a reliable computing solution that's going to last no matter where they plan to install it, and doing so quickly so they can get up and running fast.
All right. And if listeners want to know more about OnLogic, where can they find you?
Listeners can visit onlogic.com/IoT. There they can sign up for a hardware trial, download our Ultimate Guide to SCADA ebook, and browse our entire line of industrial computers. You can also choose, configure, and purchase our computers directly on our website or chat live with our team if you need help. So we hope folks will swing by on Logic.com and check out our full line of Orange on Logic Industrial Computers. And, conveniently, you'll also be hearing from us right here on the podcast for the next few episodes, so we encourage everyone to tune in to learn more about reliable hardware at the edge and hear a few more examples of how OnLogic computers are being used to make the impossible possible. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Tarun Gupta, who is the Chief Product Officer and co-founder at Skylo Technologies. So I'm excited about this because for many years, I covered satellites. It was kind of like this alternative, expensive, weird connectivity that was like bespoke and special. But now it's everywhere. And I really believe this year is like the year we're going to see it, not just in consumer handsets, but also really making waves in IoT. So that is why you're on the show today. But first, why don't you tell us about what you're doing with Skylo?
Sure. So again, thanks for having me on the podcast. Really excited to be here. Skylo is a network service provider. We are an NTN, non-terrestrial network, which is a fancy word for satellite connectivity. We provide connectivity to enterprise devices, which are things like IoT devices, as well as consumer devices and things like smartphones, as an example.
Awesome. So to help orient people who may not be super versed in satellites, I think it's important to explain things like, hey, it used to be if you wanted to have satellite connectivity, you had to have a special satellite radio on your end device. That is becoming less and less of an issue. Do you want to talk about what has changed with regards to just the specialized radios, which were expensive and sucked power?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think, you know, in the past, and when I say the past, I mean, even 3 to 5 years ago, satellite technologies were very bespoke. They were custom, and then you had to be well-versed on how satellite technology worked and, you know, have special equipment. And that special equipment was full stack from chipset to module to RF front end to antenna and to the whole package. And they were really designed for really harsh conditions where cellular didn't exist. So think about maritime, think about agriculture, and think about those locations where just cellular didn't exist and wasn't going to exist. And about 3-4 years ago, you know, the 3GPP, which is the standards body for cellular, recognized that there was a convergence coming. And we became a part of that and recognized that, hey, look, how can we bring this cellular-based technology to satellite-based protocols? And as we brought that standardized cellular technology to satellite, we recognized there was a way to really bring the scale and the magnitude of cellular devices, which is measured in, frankly, billions per year, to satellite, which is, frankly, measured in thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands per year. So bring that whole ecosystem of not just cost, but performance, battery life, manufacturing, expertise, just et cetera, to satellite. And so what we recognized was bringing cellular to satellite was a way to help the entire ecosystem evolve together into a much more dynamic, rapid way that drives down cost quite a bit. So when we look at the large satellite operators that are there today, they were completely full stacked, again, from their NOC to their core to the devices to even the use cases, frankly. But now with this convergence that we see coming, we see a, frankly, next generation and a rebirth of satellite connectivity.
Okay, and we're going to get into this standardization in a little bit. But first, I want to also help because the big story has been CubeSats and this idea that we've changed the economics of launching satellites. And we've seen a lot of startups raise money. We haven't seen full constellations deployed. But do you think that is the big change that we thought it would be back when it started?
CubeSats are extremely important for the entire satellite industry, in my opinion, but it depends on the use case. So if you think about a use case where you want to have, let's say, imaging of the planet, then CubeSats make sense. If you think about use cases where you're measuring, you know, methane gas, for example, CubeSats make sense. But if you wanted to do direct-to-device connectivity for IoT and consumer devices, then CubeSats may not make sense for you because they don't really satisfy all the checkboxes of, does it have enough power? Does it have enough longevity? Does it have enough? Does it have the right spectrum? Does it have the right power profile? So it's really, in my opinion, not around are CubeSats viable or not. It's really around what use cases are these for to understand how these are best applied.
And we've also
maybe it's CubeSats, maybe it's, I don't know, launching on, you know, the backs of SpaceX, allowing more satellites to get launched that are a little bit heavier duty. We're seeing a lot more IoT constellations. And I'm curious, where are the use cases that are compelling today? And then maybe as the economies of scale change and we actually get some of this convergence, where will the compelling use cases be for satellite connectivity in the IoT?
So again, I'd probably break this into two components. When you look at things like Kuiper and Starlink that are out there, absolutely the right thing to do for a brand new constellation using existing spectrum, but they require a brand new device at your farm or at your house or on your boat or whatever, because that is a broadband connectivity where there's plenty of spectrum available. And even for IoT and even in certain mining situations where there is a lot of devices in a small confined area, that type of, I'll call it hotspot, makes a lot of sense as well for, again, it could be for IoT because it could be truck tracking or whatnot. Where I think the challenge runs into is where you have a low number of devices or a low amount of bits, frankly, and a large geographical area. So when you think about something like that, you know, does it make sense to put a brand new antenna on every single utility pole that a utility owns across the country? That doesn't work. But what does work for them is, how can I very quickly provide connectivity from their existing device, from their existing footprint, onto an existing satellite? So I think what you'll find, again, it's use case specific, but if you're trying to look at a high concentration of devices in a very, very small amount of area, then a hotspot type of solution will work, which is, again, these new constellations. But if you look at kind of what's out there today, which is pipelines, agriculture, energy, those types of things, then frankly, you know, a low density, low bit rate type of solution, meaning existing constellation, is what works.
And we're also seeing combinations there, especially with LPWAN. So we're seeing satellite plus LoRa, satellite plus NB-IoT. There's a lot of that out there. And yeah. I'm curious, is that a viable business given that it's expensive to put stuff in the air? People are not going to want to pay really high rates for a lot of those low data applications. I mean, sure, if you're tracking jewelry or something expensive, but water filters in the Congo, I don't know.
Again, great question. I think it varies. So for example, you know, tracking a logistics truck, as an example, might not be a lot of money for tracking the truck itself, but the goods inside that truck are worth a lot of money. And when you talk about some water filter in the middle of a remote area, that water filter might not be worth a lot of money itself. However, the lives that it saves, the people that it feeds, is worth a lot of money. So who knows? Again, I think that's all relative. But with that being said, in my opinion, again, it's about leveraging the standards that are in place today. So LoRa is a great example of one where it is a terrestrial-based solution. But when you look at the number of LoRa chipsets that are out there today versus the number of NB-IoT chipsets that are out there today, you look at orders of magnitude difference. And the only way to really drive scale, which therefore drives efficiency and drives costs down, is to really take advantage of what's existing in the marketplace. And I believe, and we believe, it's NB-IoT at this stage. But it's not saying LoRa won't work. It's just a function of what we believe right now.
Okay. And going back to NB-IoT, this is a good chance for us to talk about, I know everyone who listens to the show is probably sick of me talking about release 17 of 3GPP standard, because we talk about a lot. It's what we talk about when we talk about bringing LTE advanced to factories. It's the precise positioning. There's a lot to love about it. What is so exciting about release 17 for the satellite market? What exactly is it enabling?
So the big benefit that the 3GPP allows here is, fundamentally, it allows you to use existing chipsets with a firmware upgrade to connect to existing satellites. So that means no change in hardware, no change in antennas, no change in battery life in a lot of cases. This is just a firmware upgrade on your existing hardware to have satellite connectivity.
So can you talk a little bit about what the standard enables and how long it's going to take for us to actually see it in the world?
So the release 17, I think, was ratified earlier this year. And, you know, it's interesting. So once the 3GPP ratifies the standard, it takes a couple of years for devices to... Yes. So 3GPP, you know, ratified release 17 recently, you know, mid last year or so. But what we find typically is it takes chipset manufacturers a couple of years to kind of break, you know, put those into the chipsets. And so even the chipsets we are working with today are kind of release 13 or release 14 with some features from even 15 in some cases, just depending on the device and whatnot. What we're finding with this one, though, because it unlocks a whole new set of features and this combination of cellular plus satellite, is that we're going to see devices come out this year. And so, and just with that being said, it's not full release 17 compliance. It's only, you know, it's partial release 17 compliance. But to me, this is huge. You know, coming from a couple of years ago where the chipset manufacturers were like, hey, help me understand, is there a business case or a use case here? For them actually helping to take a driver's seat to say, hey, how can we help drive this market and catalyze what's happening is really what's just driving the opportunity and driving the adoption in the marketplace. So we've seen input now from maybe 8-9 chipset vendors to some varying degrees of desire here. We've seen now multiple module manufacturers come on board, and now we're seeing actual devices come out in the marketplace that are being launched in the next 10 days. So, you know, it is really surprising to me to see Release 17 being adopted so quickly, again, in this limited format and quite aggressively by everyone we come across.
And it'll be smart connectivity, so it will use the NB-IoT ground-based stuff when it can and then satellite when it can't. Yes?
A little bit different. So yes, it's smart connectivity, meaning cellular first. So where cellular is present, it should use cellular first, and then it should use satellite where cellular doesn't exist. However, over satellite, it's NB-IoT, and over terrestrial, it can be any one of the multi-modes that are there today. So it could be LTE, it could be Cat-M, it could be 2G, it could be higher bandwidth services. So right now, Skylo is a big proponent of open standards and using cellular-based standards. And so that's why over the satellite, we use NB-IoT protocol, but we're not limiting to what you can do over the terrestrial side.
All right. So that helps explain possibly some of the things we're seeing. So as a consumer, I'm highly aware that, you know, Qualcomm has launched their efforts to bring satellite connectivity to my handset, or Apple is bringing Globalstar connectivity to their handsets. That is not the same thing as what we're talking about, correct?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So when you look at what's happening today, there are two paths to go down. One is a standards-based approach, and one is a proprietary approach. And if you look at what Qualcomm is doing with Iridium, it's a proprietary approach. And if you look at what Apple's doing with Globalstar, it's a proprietary approach. It's not wrong. It's not right. It's just proprietary. What Skylo is doing is an open standards-based approach based upon the 3GPP release 17. For the IoT consumer, what this means is that in order for you to use the Apple-based product and Apple-based services, you have to use the Apple constellation. You have to use an Apple chipset, an Apple waveform, an Apple device in that regard. So if you wanted to measure, let's say, the amount of iron in your soil in the middle of a farm, you'd have to buy an Apple-based ecosystem to make that work. If you want to do it with Qualcomm, an example for Iridium, you'd have to buy a Qualcomm chip with a Qualcomm modem in that regard and a way for that to touch to the Iridium-based ecosystem, which, again, isn't wrong. It just ties you into that ecosystem for the short and long term in that regards. What Skylo is offering is a standards-based approach, which means you could buy a chip from Altair or MediaTek or even perhaps Qualcomm or even perhaps GCT or pick any chipset manufacturer that adopts Release 17. You could use that in that regard, which because we're completely agnostic to who you use or how that device is actually put into play in the market.
Which is great because having an iPhone to power some sort of soil sensor seems like heavy overkill. Also highly likely it would get stolen. Okay. And so now that we have Release 17, we've got a lot more attention here. We've still got all these startups. We've got big companies like SpaceX and Amazon also in the broadband space. How important is it for a satellite startup to own their own constellation?
I don't think it is that important, actually. It is helpful, don't get me wrong. But when I think about the mobile operators who are really pioneering this space, no pun intended, but the mobile operators years ago recognized that they didn't need some of their core assets to make themselves successful. And so as an example of that, they chose to spin off their real estate assets, which are their tower assets. So they spun them off to the likes of Crown Castle or American Tower or SBA or whomever. A lot of their sites, for example, are on rooftops. And so what the mobile operators realized was owning the network's important. Owning, let's say, the physical assets around the real estate infrastructure wasn't that important for their core business. It was important to use them, to utilize them, to be on them, but not really own those assets. We have the same philosophy in that regard. And so when I think about the satellite networks, It is tough to design a satellite, launch a satellite, maintain a satellite, do the regulatory requirements, make sure everything is there in terms of beamforming and NOC services and all those things that happen. So what we recognized is that there is a lot of capacity that's out there in the marketplace today. We should take advantage of the best of the satellites that are out there, provide them traffic, and really focus on what we do best, which is mobile core and RAN and our eNode B and SIM strategies and all those things that happen to be able to provide the network without having to own and operate the entire value chain.
And given all the attention being paid to like light pollution, space trash, near collisions, it feels like, what would you say is the right number of companies up there operating those assets?
Oh, that's a tough one. I don't know if there is a right number, but I would say that if I were to, and Skylo's done this as well, but personally, I would bet on people that have done this for a living already. And so I think about, again, the large established satellite players that have constellations up in space for decades. These guys know what they're doing. They know how to do it. There's been, frankly, zero outages on those satellites over N years. Whereas when I think about new startup companies, there's a whole host of things that can go bad, from not just the launch, which they're not in control of, but, you know, payload doors not opening, or you're at the wrong elevation or the wrong altitude or whatever it ends up being. And as you mentioned, just collisions that can happen and will happen. And, you know, a bad batch of fuel, as an example. So I think right now, a lot of the new startups, again, I hope they all succeed, but I don't expect they all will, just based upon financial reasons and technical reasons that will eventually come out. But the large guys, they know what they're doing. They know how to handle, you know, the 190x countries of landing rights that they have, and how to really plan their next generation of constellations that, frankly, they're working on today.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much, Tarun. It was wonderful having you on the show this week.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Appreciate it.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things cast. Please join us Thursday, and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stot.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. And please subscribe.